everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a revisionist look at the history of American slavery and of how the U.S. economy was built upon the slave breeding industry. My guest is Ned Sublette, S-U-B-L-E-T-T-E. He is a historian, an investigative researcher of Americana, and regarded as the leading scholar on Cuban music. Musically, Ned has worked with John Cage, Lamont Young, and other modern contemporary composers, as well as Willie Nelson. He has degrees from the University of New Mexico and studied at University of California, San Diego. He is the author of several books, including his newest on the history of slavery, and we will get to those issues, including The American Slave Coast, The History of Slave Breeding Industry, which is an epic-sized history of the U.S. through the eyes of American slavery with enormous relevance today in our cheap labor economy, with workers serving as commodities for the elite. The American Slave Coast took 5 years to research through a residency with Washington College Star Center for the Study of American Experience. Nice to have you back with us.
Thank you, Gary.
Recently, we did an in-depth interview with our guest, and it was so important that I've invited Ned back because I felt that we just touched the surface. So today we're going to go further. And I realize that we have new people tuning into the Progressive Commentary Hour every single week. So we will reestablish some of the highlights of his earlier talk and discuss the idea that most Americans only understand one part of the slave industry. We want to talk about also not just bringing in slaves to work the plantations, but the breeding of these slaves, which became like cash in a savings bank for the owners. And this grew into a huge industry that financially benefited not only slaveholders and plantation owners and those involved in the breeding of slaves, but also industrialists, moneylenders, import-export entrepreneurs, factory owners, and more, both in the North and South. And this is the other half of the history of American slavery that is not told and remains in the dark to the vast majority of people. So, first of all, Ned, thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's pick this story up as of January 1st, 1808, a very important date in U.S. history, and to understand how the rise of the U.S. economy and the United States becoming a geopolitical power in the 19th century was, in fact, based upon the nation's slave industry. So please briefly summarize this transition from a nation that imported slaves to a nation that built a massive domestic economy that depended upon the breeding of slaves as if this was factory farming today. But instead of cows or pigs or chickens, we used Africans. The floor is yours.
Well, what happened is a long and complicated story, which is why the book is so thick. But basically, as of January 1st, 1808, the earliest permissible date, according to the U.S. Constitution, which includes this date, January 1st, 1808, as the date before which the importation of persons is the constitutional phrase, importation of such persons as states shall think proper to admit, in other words, the African slave trade, was prohibited. The Constitution said it could not be prohibited before January 1st, 1808. A 20-year protection for the African slave trade was written into the Constitution at the insistence of the South Carolina delegates. And this was a compromise on their part with the Virginia delegates. Virginia had the conditions to create a slave breeding industry. Its enslaved population did not die off the way that slaves in the rest of the hemisphere where sugar was being grown died off in 8 to 10 years, having to be replaced by fresh arrivals from Africa. In Virginia, the labor force increased by what was at the time sometimes called natural increase. So Virginia, the great slave breeder, versus South Carolina, the great slave importer, with the harbor of Charleston. Charleston brought in the largest number of Africans who were kidnapped and dragged to the United States, or the colonial precursor to the United States. Okay, at the Constitutional Convention, South Carolina delegates and Virginia delegates and everyone else cut a deal to allow a 20-year guarantee that importation can't be ended before 1808. At the time, as one of the South Carolina delegates says, Virginia has everything to gain by stopping the importations. Her slaves will rise in value. Well, the Constitution didn't say that the federal government had to prohibit the African slave trade as of January 1st, 1808, but that it could not prevent it before. As it happened, the president on January 1st, 1808 was Thomas Jefferson, who, having just brought the Louisiana Purchase into the United States, was confronted with a vast new territory that would become a market for slaves. Very proactively in 1806, Jefferson asked Congress to stop the importations. Congress obliged. Jefferson signed it. And after 1808, there was only a domestic slave trade, no longer an international one. This took a few years to get going into becoming a slave breeding industry because of the War of 1812, which intervened, made a lot of things hard to do, but by 1818 or so, it was underway, and people were being trafficked from the Upper South to the Lower South in ever larger numbers. The African slave trade had been replaced entirely with a domestic slave trade, and the input to this domestic slave trade was, of course, domestically born people. Cotton acreage could only expand as fast as enslaved women could have babies, plus 17 years for them to grow to maturity. So that one of the regulators on the speed at which the Industrial Revolution, Britain's Industrial Revolution that relied on American-grown cotton, could only grow as fast as more workers could be applied. Now, why was the African slave trade closed down? In a word, it was protectionism. Virginia had plenty of African Americans to sell and did not want the cheaper South Carolina imports of Africans competing with them. That's the short version of what happened. After that point, Jefferson, who was president at the time that the transatlantic slave trade was prohibited, it may have thought of it as a humanitarian gesture, but of course it was not a humanitarian action at all. Ending slavery would have been humanitarian. But slavery continued for another 55 years. Slavery required a slave trade, and the slave trade now was entirely domestic. It was part of the American market revolution. Now the money from the slave trade went to people in the United States, went to rich slaveholders in the United States instead of to Liverpool captains or corrupt African royals.
Could you go further, please?
Oh, sure. The people often say things like, but the North was complicit too. Well, the North was certainly complicit in terms of profiting off of slavery and slave-grown cotton. New York handled the slave-grown cotton that went to England. But the profits of the slave breeding industry itself were a Southern thing, remained in the slave-producing states. And in fact, slaves were the money in the South. There was no gold. There was no silver to speak of. Planters typically lived a year in debt. Paper money was unreliable. The safest thing to do with a hot cash flow from a bumper crop was to lock it down in the form of people, literally making slaves into human savings accounts, storing the value in their bodies, because slaves were the easiest commodity to sell. There was always a market for slaves. They could always be turned into cash. And since the South had no industry to speak of, there was really very little else to invest in. So the South was heavily committed to this kind of human money. That is to say, slaves could be used as means of exchange. They retained their value over time through having children. And they were not just labor, they were not just merchandise, but they were credit and collateral that powered the South's financial expansion. And it was an immense expansion. The largest number of millionaires per capita in Mississippi prior to 1860. Sorry, the largest number of millionaires in the United States was in Mississippi prior to 1860. After after emancipation, Mississippi became the poorest state. Slaves were all the wealth Mississippi ever had. And it was a Ponzi scheme because there was a conversion cycle. As territories became cleared, land plantations established, workforces established, at that point, there was a conversion cycle so that the territory, like first Kentucky, then Tennessee, that had been importing slaves from Virginia and Maryland, became net exporters to the new territories. This drove American expansion. The slavery South pushed heavily for American expansion, first into Alabama, into Louisiana, into Alabama, into Mississippi, into Florida, into Texas, ultimately into California, where they failed, and into Cuba, which they failed to annex also. But the slavery South was very much about expanding its territory and expanding the market for its homegrown human product.
Thank you, Dad. Now, Americans immortalized many of our nation's founding documents, such as the Declaration of Independence, and even more important, the Constitution. For some, it is as if these documents were divinely inspired and on par with religious holy books. Yet the Constitution neither authorizes nor prohibits slavery. Yet it acknowledges slavery, such as in Article 1 regarding taxation or the Three-Fifths Rule. And I want you to discuss this in a little bit of depth here. Indians excluded and those bound to service as only three-fifths a person, meaning a slave. So they weren't even considered a whole person. Are there certain sections in these founding documents that are best understood by acknowledging the central place of a slave economy in the U.S.? And also, please speak about the backdrop behind the Second Amendment's right to carry arms with respect to preserving the slave industry.
Oh, my. Okay, first of all, the Constitution and the Three-Fifths Clause, I think, would be a good place to start answering those questions. Yeah, there are parts of the Constitution that are best understood with reference to this growing need to sell slaves on the part of Virginia and Maryland slaveholders into emerging markets, but also in terms of political control. Slavery's priority, the priority of the slaveholding, the priority of slaveholders who were the entire political class of the South. Bear in mind, in South Carolina, you had to own slaves in order to hold office or have a lot of property, and property was generally held in slaves. So the rich of the South were slaveholders, and they were the political class, and their priority at every moment, their political priority, number one, number two, number three, was protecting and, if possible, increasing the value of enslaved property, very much like holding shares in a company and hoping that expecting those shares to appreciate in value. By annexing new territory, one's slave holdings could double or triple in value without changing anything. Okay, in terms of the Constitution, a book that I recommend to people interested in this, a wonderful book, and it's short, by David Waldstreicher, called Slavery's Constitution, that discusses all the ways the Constitution obliquely sometimes touches on slavery. In terms of Three-Fifths Clause was very overtly a way to allow the South to vote its wealth. Okay? There was a controversy at the Constitutional Convention whether representation should be based on population or whether it should be based on wealth contributions to the national budget. The South Carolina delegates were, of course, in favor of wealth. Virginia, which had the largest population and lots of money, stood to benefit either way. But the compromise that they settled on with the non-slave states was for the South to count three-fifths of the kind of wealth that only it had, that is, slaves, for the purposes of representation, which is to say the slave masters got to vote on behalf of their enslaved people times 0.6. This 0.6 figure was nothing more than a compromise for how much to rig the process in favor of the slave owners. It didn't really mean that slaves were three-fifths of a person. Legally, slaves were zero-fifths of a person because they did not have legal personhood. Okay? So the Three-Fifths Clause was very simply and very overtly at the time a way to allow the South to vote its particular kind of wealth held in enslaved people. This was not popular in the North, and this distorted American government in favor of the slaveholding class until slavery ended, all the way through the those years of American government between the Constitution and the war that ended slavery. The governmental representation was proportionally distorted in favor of slave owners. Now, you asked about the Second Amendment. Of course, the function of a militia, the main function of a militia in the South, as everyone knew, was slave patrol. The preventing slave rebellion was a principal military priority at all times. It was a major priority during what we sometimes call the Revolutionary War. I prefer to call it the War of Independence or the War of 1812 in both cases. The enslaved were a fifth column at home. The South Carolinians felt they needed federal troops to help them protect against the possibility of slave rebellion. They had to stay home and guard their plantations instead of going off to war. The potential of the enslaved as a force in a military situation was a calculation that always had to be taken into account. The enslaved would escape whenever it was possible. It was not so easy to escape from the Deep South because once Andrew Jackson had conquered Florida, the entire Deep South was a prison from which it was very difficult to escape. The main function of these local militias was to guard against slave rebellion, and was to guard against slave escape. There are many, many stories of slaves being caught by patrollers without a pass and subjected to all kinds of abuse and punishment and even death.
Ned, give us an idea of the scope of the slave economy. Can you run down some of the figures or statistics to show the amount of wealth generated, the number of slaves, and the extent of the slave operations across the southern states at the height of the slave industry? And in what other ways did the slave breeding industry and the increase in slave labor indirectly improve other national industries or contribute to the building of the nation's infrastructure, such as America's paved highway?
I think that most important numbers to keep in mind, the basic fundamental number is on the one hand 389,000 and on the other hand 4 million. Okay, 389,000 is our best estimate of the number of Africans brought to the present day territory of the United States. That's the Altus and Richardson number. Some people say a little bit higher, maybe 500,000, but not millions. Africans were only the seed, okay? 389,000 Africans over several generations transformed into, by the time of the secession of the southern governments, 3.9 million, call it 4 million, enslaved African Americans, according to the 1860 U.S. Census. So 389,000 Africans became 4 million African Americans. Somebody made a profit on the birth of every one of those 4 million, and probably their parents and probably their grandparents. If an enslaved child was worth $50 to $75 to $100 at birth, depending on the moment, you can see that the growth to 4 million people was itself an economic expansion. By which I mean that a child being worth $75 at birth didn't mean the child was about to be sold for $75. It meant that the slave owner was worth $75 more on paper. That amount would increase as the child got older, as every year slaveholders marked their slaveholdings to market. Okay, so this the creating capital, creating credit is creating money, and the birth of every child created credit, which then made it possible for Southern secessionists to say that they were faced with the imminent loss, if the abolitionists had their way, of $4 billion in property. And indeed, the war that decommissioned human property, sometimes called the Civil War, that war was the wiped $4 billion of property off the books, remaking American money entirely because the enslaved people, which in South Carolina was 57% of the people, had been counted on the books as capital assets, which is to say, as money. Okay, that was your first question. I'm sorry, what was your second question?
I also wanted to know how this enormous slave breeding industry increased the national industries or contributed to the building of the nation's infrastructure.
Oh, well, you know, the infrastructure was it was kind of lopsided because the southern politicians were very much against infrastructural improvements then as now. They didn't want the federal government improving things in other states and them possibly having to pay for it, and they certainly didn't want what happened with the building of the Erie Canal, generally considered one of the young country's proudest can-do moments, which was all done with paid labor, right? The Erie Canal employed enormous numbers of people. This is exactly what the South did not want to happen. The South, if there was going to be work done in the South, they wanted it to be done with slave labor, which would have to be hired from them. And in no case did they want to pay taxes. So the net result, as every traveler commented, or as you can see by looking at any kind of map of the antebellum South that shows any kind of industrial features or railroads, the South was very underdeveloped and increasingly underdeveloped with respect to the non-slavery territory. That's first of all. The federal road, the National Highway, which was built during a brief period when it was possible to dream of large-scale federal projects, Henry Clay's American System, which the South subsequently shut down. Henry Clay's American System National Highway, approximately the route of the future U.S. 40, was ironically a great boon to slave traders who could send their slave coffles over paved roads with bridges over all the rivers going out to Wheeling, to be able to go down from there by river transport all the way down to Natchez in New Orleans.
Your wife and yourself spent years in various archives studying texts and letters and stories by both the white slave breeders and those involved in the industry, as well as slaves themselves, particularly African-American women, whose lives were for 15 years or more, served no other purpose than the birth of babies who would then, of course, enter the slave market. Give a personal flavor to this conversation by recounting a couple of the more dramatic stories that capture the life of a black woman and her family of children who were forced to do nothing but breed.
Well, thank you for mentioning my wife. I was about to. My wife, Constance Sublett, is my co-author on this book. She's not here with me tonight, but all of this work we did together. It took us 5 years, pretty much full time, working on this book to get it done, and it was something that one head could not have contained. So it's been a real blessing to be able to do this with Constance. Yes, you're right. It's all too easy when you talk about numbers and politics and policies and laws and statistics to lose sight of the fact that we're talking about human beings, which is why all of this is so very horrific. The slave breeding industry, among the other things it was a machine for recursively chewing up black families in generation after generation, systematically impoverishing black people while extracting value that built vast family webs for slave owners. These inequities exist still. It takes many, many, many generations to undo the effects of hereditary wealth or hereditary poverty. And the fact that women, of course, were doubly enslaved, they had to labor in the field and they also had to labor in childbirth, and women were expected to have babies as early and as often as possible until their bodies gave out, at which point they might be like Minerva Granger, who legally belonged to Thomas Jefferson, who at the age of 55 was appraised as being worth nothing. Lost my spot there. Be right back. In terms of how this came to affect the lives of the individuals involved, most of the millions of enslaved women lived and died without writing their own names, without giving us much testimony. So the testimonies we do have are particularly valuable. It's very clear that slavery was rape. I mean, sexual violation was part and parcel of slavery. We see this in all kinds of ways demonstrated in the oral histories of formerly enslaved people, in the slave narratives written by formerly enslaved people and published in the 19th century. There's one letter in the book in particular that is the most, I think it's sort of the emotional core of the book, a chapter called A Letter from Virginia. Virginia is the name of an enslaved woman who in 1853 was apparently discarded by the slave trader whom she had been serving as a concubine. If she was a slave trader's concubine, she was almost certainly very light-skinned. And she was sold away along with her children while pregnant, and a letter exists in the Rice C. Ballard archive. Rice Ballard was a slave trader at the University of North Carolina, which is an incredible piece of writing. If I might read just a little bit of it. Houston, May 6th, 1853. Dear sir, permit me to address you a few lines which I hope you will receive soon. I am at present in the city of Houston in a Negro trader's yard for sale by your orders. I was present at the post office when Dr. Ewing took your letter out through mistake and read it aloud, not knowing I was the person the letter alluded to. I hope that if I have ever done or said anything that has offended you, that you will forgive me, for I have suffered enough sense in mind to repay all that I have ever done to anyone. You wrote for them to sell me in 30 days. Do you think after all that has transpired between me and the old man, I don't call names, that it's treating me well to send me off among strangers in my situation, to be sold without even my having an opportunity of choosing for myself? It's hard indeed, and what is still harder, for the father of my children to sell his own offspring, yes, his own flesh and blood. My God, is it possible that any free-born American would brand his charities with such a stigma as that? But I hope before this he will relent and see his error, for I still believe that he is possessed of more honor than that. Well, the letter goes on. It's quite a complicated and frustratingly incomplete story that stretches out through the letter. And we have no idea what happened to her. The only trace that she ever existed really is this letter and a couple of letters addressing the issue of her sale, which happened to survive in the archive of the slave trader that she somehow managed to smuggle a letter out to from a, quote, Negro trader's yard, close, in Houston.
How would you characterize the men of the Deep South, and perhaps there were even white women, who entered the slave breeding and slave auction industry? What kind of people were they? Clearly they held some ideals of white supremacy and looked down upon African Americans as inferior, and they were devoted Christians. I ask this question because at this moment we are witnessing a rapid increase in the worst of racism and bigotry, not exclusively upon the right, but across the spectrum of American ideologies and against African Americans and Latinos. When you look at the goofballs as candidates running for the top office, the most powerful position in the world, not one of the candidates, not one of the presidents, not one of the administrators of great office and agency have any spiritual leanings. You would think that we would want a Gandhi, a Martin Luther King, a Spinoza, Eurycles, Maimonides, a Socrates. We would want someone who understands the nature of problems at the root, not merely reflective and reactive at the extreme end of a problem crashing and burning, like ISIS, and then, well, we'll kill more ISIS, which then will create more ISIS that will kill more, and this nonstop circular motion. That's who we have today. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about these individuals in the 17th and 18th century. Do you feel that there is anything analogous to the business leaders of that time in the slave industry compared to the corporate leaders, the some of the religious leaders, some of the union leaders, some of the academic leaders today?
It's a slippery slope when you try to map all of this onto what's happening today. First of all, because what's happening today is changing so fast, it's a different kind of study. I think it's an important thing to do, but in the book we kind of kept back from making too many contemporary analogies, partly because by the time the book was published, something else may have happened that even dwarfs what we were experiencing before. So it's tricky. I will say that we have some pretty appalling characters in our history. And, you know, even, you know, I hate to say this, but, I mean, Donald Trump, with his calls to expel how many people from within our borders, reminds me of no one so much as Thomas Jefferson, who advocated expelling all of the black people from the United States for a period of 45 years or so. He held this position, maybe longer. He advocated it in his Notes in the State of Virginia, published in the 1780s, and 45 years later, in a letter, he was still advocating it and postulating a scheme for how a flotilla could recursively carry away generation after generation of black children until every one of them was gone, because he truly believed that black and white could not live together in peace. So, unfortunately, it seems that we have a hard, that at some point, some kind of amnesia sets in, and we have chosen to forget things that could guide us. We have chosen to forget that there was a slave breeding industry. The term slave breeding was very common in the 1850s. Abolitionists used it. Southerners denied it as a damn lie. It's, you know, in, it's something that we haven't been talking about in the narrative of American history. As to your question about what kind of people were slave traders, religion, all of that, the generation of Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry, even Pierce Butler, even slave trader Henry Lawrence, all of these men at some point exhibited in their letters at least some kind of perhaps superficial, perhaps deeper sense that this was not right, that there was something about slavery that was wrong. Patrick Henry famously wrote of the general inconvenience of living without slaves, but acknowledged that slavery was wrong. Well, this later changes with John C. Calhoun. By the 1830s, a different ideology has taken hold, and the ideology gets more and more unmoored from reality, it seems, with every passing decade. By the 1830s, we are seeing an ideology that extols slavery as a positive good for mankind and a gift from a benevolent God. By this time, the northern and southern churches are all splitting off from each other into two branches, because all the southern churches, of course, were pro-slavery. Recently, there's been a big to-do about Woodrow Wilson, right, at Princeton, right? People have, the black students, God bless them, have demanded that, and not only black students, have demanded that Princeton stop treating Woodrow Wilson as the great man, and rather acknowledge him as the man who implemented Jim Crow in the federal government and who kept black people out of prison,
And got us into the First World War.
Got us into the First World War, but he was a hardcore racist. And his father, interestingly, was a preacher who wrote just before Georgia seceded, wrote a sermon called, I believe it was called Music. He preached a sermon that was published by his congregation. This was the week before Georgia seceded from the Union. Mutual relation of masters and slaves is taught in the Bible. Joseph Ruggles Wilson, Woodrow was four at the time, when his father was preaching that slavery was something to cherish, that he spoke of the North as the infidel fanaticism. He spoke of a divine warrant for the institution, meaning slavery, we are resolved to cherish. He wrote, if slaveholders preserve it as an element of social welfare in the spirit of the Christian religion, throwing into it the full measure of gospel salt, etc., right? This is Woodrow Wilson's father, who is preaching to an approving congregation in Georgia that is just about to leave the Union, that slaveholders must cherish, that the least, that the pleasing sight of the institution of domestic slavery would save a lower race from the destruction of heathenism. This was the mindset. And for a slave trader, it was very convenient and I suspect necessary to think of the people that the slave trader was abusing to be somehow less than human. I'd avoid psychological explanations, but I don't see how you could explain it otherwise. Slave traders were generally, even the wealthiest ones, and we tell the story in the book of the best known and largest slave trader of the 1830s, Isaac Franklin, who was known for raping young women in his custody. Of course, slave traders bought people outright. They often did not co-sign, but owned the people that they were taking to market. And as a slave owner could abuse the enslaved any way that the slave owner wanted. And slave traders were notorious for sexual abuse of the enslaved. They were looked down upon by polite society. But, of course, having money can work social miracles, and Isaac Franklin in particular made a decision to get out at the perfect time. He timed the market perfectly. He got out just before the panic of 1837, and with his wealth made a transition to being a respected plantation owner instead of a despicable slave trader. He married a preacher's daughter and got a plantation going in Louisiana, which he named Angola, which was subsequently deeded to the state and became the Louisiana penitentiary that it is today.
We know that many of the nation's founding fathers that you've mentioned were slaveholders. You did not mention George Washington. Yes, Thomas Jefferson. Andrew Jackson. Zachary Taylor. Being the largest slave owners. At the same time, American historians try to memorialize many of their words that suggest that they also favored abolition, such as all men are created equal. What would you like to share about the truth behind our founding fathers' position on slavery and whether or not all men are born equal and free? Because just keep in mind today, if you go around the world, you look at many nations, they are not born free. They're born into a caste system in India, one of the most racist nations in the world. I'm appalled that the major media has not focused upon the number of baby girls killed by their parents, mainly the mother. The father doesn't kill them more often than not, taking them out, putting the baby on the ground, filling his mouth with sand, then filling it with water. Upwards of 5 million a year. Now, if you do the math, even if you're off by 20%, you still come to 200 million babies killed this way, and it's probably a lot higher. You would think that if someone's killing 5 million of its own a year, someone would make that an issue. It is not. Even Gandhi couldn't get it stopped. Then you look in countries where women are treated in most countries today. The majority of women in the world on the planet, if you do the statistics by country, are not given the same rights as men. That means that they are treated in that country by some similarity and by some measure the same as African women were treated. Many women have no rights at all except what the religion gives them or the government control through a theocracy gives them. And we don't discuss this because if we did, then we would have to challenge Saudi Arabia, a completely racist, completely sociopathic society. There's not one redeeming value I can find in all of Saudi Arabia. Its policies, its monarchy, its absolutism, its religious beliefs, which are the most radical terrorist views of Wahhabism, this perverse form of Islam, how they treat women, the most beheadings, lashings. They're the biggest sponsor, along with Turkey, who shot down a Russian jet. But we won't criticize Turkey for arming, training, harboring ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We'll say that they had a right to shoot down a Russian plane that was after ISIS. The bizarreness of what we're seeing today and yet we will not defend the women in the countries. In Qatar, we won't defend the women. In Kuwait, we won't defend the women. In Afghanistan, we won't defend the women. So how does this reconcile towards women today as you would look around the world in a so-called civilized world today compared to how blacks were treated 200 years ago?
Well, I can't comment on a number of the things you just mentioned, India, none of that. I can't really speak to that. I don't know about this. But what I can say is that even in say, Thomas Jefferson's time, a white married woman had no right to say no either. Virginia law didn't even recognize spousal rape as a crime until 1986. Jefferson bred his wife to death with repeated pregnancies that killed her. John Quincy Adams nearly did the same. His wife had 14 pregnancies in which she miscarried 9 times, 5 of them within the 3.5 years before her first birth. She had 1 stillborn child and 4 live children, one of whom died at the age of 2, right? But those women at least got to choose their husbands, and their children weren't sold. Imagine if the wives of the great men of the land were treated like that. Imagine how the lowest of the low socially were treated.
Discuss with us the black slave owners and breeders, their wealth, their power, and why has history not focused upon their contribution to the suffering, misery, and genocide of their own race?
Well, there were not that many.
Please don't apologize.
There were some.
That's insulting.
You're insulting
my audience.
Yeah. Say what?
That's insulting to my audience.
Yeah, I mean, there were not as many. Now, in Saint-Domingue, okay, the future Haiti, there were 25 to 30% of the slaves were owned by free people of color who were viewed as a separate caste from the black enslaved or the grand whites or the petty whites, as they call them. They were considered a separate caste. Something of the same thing happened in Louisiana, in particular, where there was a caste of free people of color, generally lighter-skinned, who owned plantations with slaves. But in Virginia, in Maryland, you really didn't have this phenomenon. In the cities, South didn't have much in the way of cities, but in the cities, the relatively small number of free people of color in the South were concentrated, and they were an important part of life in those towns. Few of them were large slave owners, if any. I don't know of any large black slave owners in South Carolina or Virginia. I might add that in both Spanish Louisiana and in Cuba, there are cases of slaves owning other slaves whose work they could exploit to pay for their own freedom.
I stand on the side of those historians who view the Civil War and the North's staunch commitment to keep the nation united and undivided as an economic strategy, because the industries and mills in the North were fully independent upon the Southern produce and commodities being generated by the South slaves' economy. So one question is whether or not the North's economic concerns were really what was paramount in Lincoln's decision to enter a war. And if so, would this not have made the issue of abolition of the slavery as an important footnote to the causes behind the Civil War?
Well, that's certainly what my Southern grandmother told me. We all heard that one. But, I mean, the Civil War was about slavery. I mean, just no way around that. And the best way to show that is look at what the primary secessionists all said. The secession was presented to Lincoln as a fait accompli. The But Lincoln's great moment, the great moment of that war, I believe, was the Emancipation Proclamation, which is why I view what some people call the Civil War as a revolutionary war. In 1859, there was no reason to think that slavery was about to end. It was pretty clear that there was a war coming, but I don't think anyone in the South or North much thought that slavery would really be completely abolished as a result of it. When Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, it not only pronounced the enslaved free in territories that Lincoln had no control over, but it also, well, first of all, it discouraged British investors from investing further in enslaved property, but it also provided for the arming of black people and the enlistment of them as soldiers into the army. Previously, black people had not been able to enlist in the Union Army. And I don't think the exact number is known, but some 200,000 black people enlisted in the army and fought in what was now explicitly a war against slavery, and which ended with the decommissioning of this vast class of property that had always been legal. I think it was the great revolutionary moment in American history.
What do you think about Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, declaring all slaves within the Confederate States as free, yet of course the war continued for another 2 years. Then following the Civil War, the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery throughout the U.S.,
but
was that the end of slavery, or did the slave industry somehow morph into other forms of business and commerce that kept former slaves enslaved economic conditions, such as debt slavery?
Yeah, I think it's very well established that what followed emancipation was a horror. The post-bellum neo-slavery of convict leasing that made, you know, Birmingham, Alabama, a steel capital, and it went on in the South through the Second World War, right? I mean, there's all kinds of oppression we can point to: the prison industrial complex, the modern mass incarceration state, migrant exploitation, sex trafficking, coerced labor, sweatshop labor. And it's not at all uncommon to hear people say, oh, but slavery still continues, slavery's still going on. And I'm not going to say that's not true, but scholars today speak of slaveries to differentiate various kinds of slaveries, because there's many, many forms of slavery. And I'm not really, my brief at this point is not really to speak about present-day practice, because we're writing about a previous time primarily.
But let me interject here, because we're coming near the end of our program.
Sure.
I do want to end the program with a thought.
Yeah.
And I'd like a very short answer at the end. For the last 35 years, the United States has seen the loss of over 30 million jobs.
Yeah.
Some of those people were able to find jobs in the same industry, but a different company. But this was the outsourcing. This was the corporate takeover. These were what I consider economic genocidalists. That's a term I coined to describe the equity partnerships, the corporate raiders, the Carl Icahns and people like that. They buy a company because they can, usually with someone else's money and debt. They then strip off its assets, and then they sell it or they keep it for a period of time. But their object is not to enhance the well-being and lifestyle and standard of living of people in a community, to hold a community together. Hence, we had a wasteland in the United States. Today, no politician will stand up and say, I will never allow corporate jobs, corporations to take factories, close them down, and ship that overseas. To the contrary, these people are given massive amounts of money from Wall Street that backs those big corporations if they do exactly that. As a result, What you see now is a person having to work two jobs to earn at the end of the year, as far as take-home pay, what would actually be supporting their lifestyle, adjusted for inflation, what they did 40 years ago. So we don't have people who can, most people, over 200 million Americans, who have a quality of life today, but they have a massive amount of debt. And it's going to get worse with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, with the Atlantic Partnership, with GATT and NAFTA and CAFTA and all these trade agreements. It's allowing foreign companies and American companies to do business in foreign lands to take brand names, put them in another country, have very cheap labor make it, bring it back in the United States. So then when we say, well, what about an American job? Then you have to say, well, if I can buy a refrigerator from China or from another country for one half the price, I'm going to buy it. And so I see a whole new form of debt, peonage, and massive economic harm coming to a whole new generation of Americans. And our government is behind it, corporations behind it, the media is not challenging it. Many of the institutions that should be out there in the streets raising hell about it are not. So what happens when you do get a job in the next 5 years in America at a factory? The likelihood is you're going to be competing with workers in China, in India, in Bangladesh to make a dress or to make a tire or to make a window for a car. And we're going to be reverting back to where people must do some kind of work just to survive, but the standard of their living will be so abysmal compared to anything that we have seen in recent times that it will be a step backwards. Your final thoughts?
Ultimately, the agenda of the slave society seems all too familiar to us in the 21st century world. We're not yet at the point where the entire economy is dependent on the production of chattel laborers by female reproduction workers, with people sold on the corner, with children sold. Nobody alive can imagine what the people who lived in that world of total slavery endured. But the history of this industry demonstrates how far the unrestrained pursuit of profit can go. And we have to stop
it. I agree, Ned. And all you have to do is look at India and the children making bricks, the children sewing at the young age, carpets, people being exploited around the world, women making 14 cents an hour, working 16-hour days in Bangladesh under terrible conditions. And yet we, the United States, our government, our politicians, our media, our business community and Wall Street support that, even though they wouldn't their child to work in those conditions. So, yes, we do have different forms of slavery today, and we have learned no lesson, it seems, from our past.
So it would
Ned Sublett, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate your input.
Thank you, Gary.
And Ned is the author of The American Slave Coast. His website, Ned, what is your website, please?
I don't have a website.
Okay.
It's The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry by Ned and Constance Sublett.
Thank you very much. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program.